Blog Talk Radio.
Without the light, or the darkness comes. Hold through the night, the shadows will run. Fend off the enemy. The jubilee with all the fire we can breathe. We're singing all day and you can't tame it. High tide, low tide, you know. Night time, morning time, yeah. We're going strong, heading up, down the river. Oh Lord, I feel the reveling. I feel a change on the
class. Got a lot of stuff we're going to be discussing in this particular segment. Those of you that may have questions, you can definitely give us a call at 319-527-6090. We're going to be talking about everything from CECL implementation, the new accounting standards, all the stuff that you can kind of look to get into at the end of what we will call, well, actually the beginning of the fiscal year 2021. Right now, we just ask you to sit back, take notes, have your questions prepared, because each and everything that we discuss in this particular segment is for educational purposes only. We do not profess to give legal advice. Each and everything you're going to hear in this particular broadcast for educational purposes only. So with that being said, we ask that you take this information and utilize it in its proper perspective. Without further ado, like I say, get ready to take notes, because what you're going to be hearing should inspire you.
Greetings, greetings, greetings. You are now tuned into the vault. Trust Christian, own nothing, control everything. Just want to thank you for tuning in live or listening in a replay. Back once again, 2019, with another episode of the Vault 100% Private Money 101. Excited about this episode and talking to you all. It's been a missing for me. I know it's been a missing for a lot of other individuals. And I know it's going to be a lot of people tuning in and wanting to actually connect with us tonight. So I'm really excited. Thank you, Lorenzo Warren. Thank you, AUIG Davis. We're just going to do a bunch of thank yous as well. So I'm really excited about the audience tonight. And I appreciate all of you all sending us emails. Thank you, Gustavo, for tuning in live. Appreciate you. And look forward to it. Yeah, Glenn, yeah, Ernest Robinson, so excited. It's a pleasure, everyone, to be back. So I know everyone is new to the vault. You guys may be hearing me doing an extended greeting tonight or today, wherever you are in the world, just because the absence of Trust Christian in the vault. A. Kent, thank you for tuning in live. Ernest Robinson, it's just been it's been a while. 2018 has some time to kind of do some things and grow to the next level, and it's been a joy. A bunch of families have been impacted by the vault in a positive way. The community has grown, and that's where the attention has been. It's been focused in the private because the private is where all the power is, and so that's why today it's rather important to come back out in 2019 and talk about and address the 100% private money, because a lot of individuals have been educated in public money and public funds, but who knows about the private money and or equity? And so there are two sets of information, ladies and gentlemen. There's public and there's private. And so today we're just going to go over and discuss the private education that individuals receive or families receive at the vault, and what you can look forward to in private trustee training. So really exciting, and we're going to be going over that today, particularly about private money. And the reason why I thought this was an exceptional topic to come back out and talk about in 2009, thanks Trey Stone for tuning in live, missed you as well. The reason why I thought it was important to talk about private money, once again, is because there's two types of education. There's private and there's public, but you know, I want to give you all some family names that you all can see that are inside the vault and have their own vault. Individuals and families such as the Rothschilds, such as the Morgans, such as the Rockefellers. They all practice what's called own nothing, control everything. And these are families that have banking cartels internationally. Thanks Rashad and B for tuning in live. And B Alexandria, excuse me. And I really wanted to share with you all, you know, I know you all look at the Forbes list. That's a relatively public information source of wealth. But I would challenge you all to think about what makes you think that the Rothschilds, one of the largest banking families in the world, is not, why are they not on the Forbes list? You know, is it because they're not American? But when we look at the Morgans, when we look at the Rockefellers were actually in the United States. The Carnegies were actually in the United States. And once again, they practiced a thing called own nothing, control everything, which all wealth is held inside of the trust. All wealth is held inside of the private. This is why you hear so many wealthy families inside of trust. It's because the practice having money inside of a own nothing, control everything perspective, inside a private money scenario. Thank you, Vincent, for tuning in live. So let's just kind of talk about that tonight. Before your eyes every single day. Here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Private education, first thing you learned in our private community, it's all about jurisdiction. What jurisdiction is the money in? Everyone on this line and this stream knows there's a difference between a public corporation and a private corporation. But most people don't know how a private corporation is formed, but they know how to go down and file at the Secretary of State and go get a public corporation. What is a private corporation? Ladies and gentlemen, that's a corporation that's held in trust. That is a corporation where you look at, we'll go through the first family of example. The Gates family right now. Everyone that's in America used to know that Bill Gates used to be what's called the richest man in the world. But Bill Gates was the richest man in the world before he learned own nothing, control everything. He went through his tax situation. And then you saw the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And then you saw Microsoft make its largest dividend distribution of money, public money, once again, from a public corporation that's publicly traded on the stock market to a private family foundation. $1 billion dividend distribution given tax-free. $1 billion plus. And has been going on for years. Because that's called private money, 100% private money. You all can go look up the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. You can go see that it is a private family foundation. It's not a public foundation. It's a private foundation. Why is it a private foundation? Because it's held in trust. All of that money is held in trust. It's in a private trust. Let's talk about this. Private money. How is it held privately? It's held in a trust. Well, what is a trust? A trust is a contract. And let's look at the law of contracts. The law of contracts says contract makes the law. Let's learn how we can use an old-time strategy by the elite to create and pass on generational wealth tax-free. Because when that money goes into that private family foundation, it's given tax-free. It's a 501c3 entity. It's a charity. They're public charities and they're private charities. There's public money and there's private money. So I wanted to share this with you all today. I know a lot of individuals say, oh, I want to go private. I want to be private. First rule of being private. Own nothing, control everything. There's a gentleman, as I've traveled, I saw that there's a gentleman. His name is... Let me get his name back up real quick for you all. This gentleman's name. J.B. Pritzker. Be ready to put it in the chat for you all. If you're not on the chat, you'll get a chance to. I'll hopefully get a chance to see it. Pritzker. He's actually running for, I think this is governor, in Chicago. And so, this individual is a billionaire. And I like this article that I read about him because it talks about private money. First of all, a blind trust would imply that whatever's going on is private. Thank you, Colby, for tuning in live. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in live. If I haven't talked to you live, please feel free to shout us out and say hello. Why is this so imperative? He's a billionaire, but he's running for public office. And I was talking to a trustee, a senior trustee, about this the other day. And we were talking about how when you run for public office, there has to be a level of disclosure that's given to the public. First of all, if you don't own anything, how do you live in a multi-million dollar house? How do you have jets? How do you have $200,000 vehicles in your driveway if you don't own anything? Well, when you go into the public... to hold a public office, there's certain levels of disclosure that have to be given. This man has a family estate. His family estate has been now appointed Northern Trust Company. So as you can see, there's a third party now. They're an independent trustee over the assets that this individual in their family estate, private money. But because this individual wants to go into a public office, there has to be a certain level of disclosure in the public. He's not actually running for a Chicago governor. He's running for Illinois because you can't be a governor, I think, of a city. You have to be governor of a state. So I just want to be clear. I don't want anyone to make any comments on the back end as if I'm not knowledgeable of that. Earl Monroe, appreciate you for tuning in live. And so you all can look up J.B. Pritzker. I put it in the chat. And I wanted to share with you another individual, the President of the United States currently, Donald Trump. We've been talking about this since he's been elected. This individual said, I don't have any tax returns to show. Well, how are you a billionaire riding around on a jet? You got a multi-million dollar house that you live in, but you don't own it. You don't even have a tax return to show that you can afford to live in it. It's called private money, 100% private money. And this is 101. Private money 101 says you have to own nothing, control everything. Family trusts are erected. For all of you all that want to do community building, that's through a private real estate investment trust. Private family trust. See, there's two types of trust. There's two types of everything. They got the public and they got the private. So you all say, well, give me an example of what the public one is. Just one example. It's called Social Security. Social Security is for the public welfare, the public funds. Everything that's public goes into Social Security. Everything that private goes into the private. Jack Bone, thanks for tuning in live. So, thanks, Jack Bone. I appreciate the comment. I just really wanted to go over that today. I'm actually open for questions. My messages are never long nowadays. They're very, very brief, very straight, very to the point of letting you all know. Individuals, when individuals say, if there's two different types of contracts, public contracts and private contracts, did you all know contract law is private law? That's why you don't get that education in public school. Did you know the law library is waiting for you? That's a private environment. That's made for individuals that want to learn how to protect their private rights. See, I'll probably have just have to do an episode about is privacy under attack, because it's not. Even though you all have seen, why is it public? Because, no sound. Okay, Vincent Terry, thanks. Thanks, Vincent Terry. Thanks, Big Smile. Newbie. Vincent, can you hear me? Alrighty, thank you, Vincent. So, I don't know where I fell off, Vincent, but I'm going to start back out about, is privacy under attack? Is private money attack? It's not under attack. Why? Because the same individual that everyone had an issue with in the public, talking about he's taking their private pictures and their private everything and releasing it to the public and selling it, the same agreement, which is a private contract that you agreed to, you as a private person, I shouldn't call you a private person because a person is a corporation, it's an association, and it's a trust. It's an entity. It's a dead entity. So, the same individual you guys may be questioning whether your privacy is under attack through Facebook, this individual did the same thing that Bill Gates did. As soon as he...
Now. All right. Now, see, here's where the rubber meets the road for a lot of people. When they hear certain things like that, it actually raises a certain level of awareness. It also raises certain questions. When we talk about accounting, a lot of people are pivoting between that public and private information. And here's where it kind of gets really serious. You have been conducting business and commerce, and no one ever told you that you were expected to be an expert. Matter of fact, when you're in commerce, you are expected to be an expert. They are treating you as if you are a financial guru, and you know all of these things. You're just choosing, you're volunteering, you're acquiescing to these things that are happening. For example, here in the United States, going to prison is actually a benefit. It's a privilege. It's a benefit. It's a public privilege to go to prison, because in other countries, they're not going to expend those type of resources if you are deemed a not-so-pliable member of society. They're just going to take you out back and have you go out with a shovel and dig a hole. The end. So because of this system, we do not understand how these things are applicable. And so we go through our daily lives oblivious to the invisible barriers. See, in a physical prison, you know you're in a prison because you can see the guards, you can see the wall, you can see the type of food you're receiving, you can see what you're wearing, you see where you're living. You will understand that there are rules and provisions that govern what's being done. Now watch this. Inside of the cinder block facility, everything that's inside of that cinder block facility, there are rules that govern everything from the air you breathe to the food you eat. And right on the other side of that physical concrete wall is what they call the free world. And in the free world, the same air that both of you guys breathe, there are rules that are governing those that are on one side of the wall that are very different from the rules that are governing those on the inside. But here's the secret. Both sides have similar capabilities that we don't really understand. Let me give an example. See, in every prison, even in prison, you have the general population. And then you also have, see, even in prison, you have trustees. Well, Bazell, what are trustees? Well, trustees are individuals that are within the domain. We're going to talk about it from a prison perspective. You're in a prison domain, but you have special privileges. You know, while everyone else is told to go to lockdown and this, that, and the other, well, you get to kind of stay out and hang out with the COs. You get to, you know, frolic, you know, and kind of come and go like you want. You can go all over the facility. You have more of a domain. And here's the secret. The actual trustees actually run the prison. They make sure that the facility is clean. They make sure that the food is prepared. They take everything from preparing the food to cleaning the area to maintenance on the vehicles that they're using. It is an entire ecosystem run by trustees. Now I want you to understand, I want you now to take this information and turn it on its head. You're in a world where you're in a prison that you can't see, taste, or touch, and you are under the illusion that you're free. But when you violate one of these commercial codes, then you are held accountable. That's why this is called a counting class, because you're being held accountable, and you must be able to understand what you're being held accountable to. This next clip is going to open your eyes even further. Keep listening, because if you listen long enough, you just might learn something.
A notary public in the common law world is a public officer constituted by law to serve the public in non-contentious matters usually concerned with estates, deeds, powers of attorney, and foreign and international business. A notary's main functions are to administer oaths and affirmations, take affidavits and statutory declarations, witness and authenticate the execution of certain classes of documents, take acknowledgments of deeds and other conveyances, protest notes and bills of exchange, provide notice of foreign drafts, prepare marine or ships protests in cases of damage, provide exemplifications and notarial copies, and perform certain other official acts depending on the jurisdiction. Any such act is known as a notarization. The term notary public only refers to common law notaries and should not be confused with civil law notaries. With the exceptions of Louisiana, Puerto Rico, Quebec, whose private law is based on civil law, and British Columbia, whose notarial tradition stems from scrivener notary practice, a notary public in the rest of the United States and most of Canada has powers that are far more limited than those of civil law or other common law notaries, both of whom are qualified lawyers admitted to the bar. Such notaries may be referred to as notaries at law or lawyer notaries. Therefore, at common law, notarial service is distinctly different from the practice of law, and giving legal advice and preparing legal instruments is forbidden to lay notaries such as those appointed throughout most of the United States of America. Overview: notaries are appointed by a government authority, such as a court or lieutenant governor, or by a regulating body often known as a society or faculty of notaries public. For lawyer notaries, an appointment may be for life, while lay notaries are usually commissioned for a briefer term, with the possibility of renewal. In most common law countries, appointments and their number for a given notarial district are highly regulated. However, since the majority of American notaries are lay persons who provide officially required services, commission numbers are not regulated, which is part of the reason why there are far more notaries in the United States than in other countries. Furthermore, all U.S. and some Canadian notarial functions are applied to domestic affairs and documents, where fully systematized attestations of signatures and acknowledgement of deeds are a universal requirement for document authentication. By contrast, outside North American common law jurisdictions, notarial practice is restricted to international legal matters or where a foreign jurisdiction is involved, and almost all notaries are also qualified lawyers. For the purposes of authentication, most countries require commercial or personal documents which originate from or are signed in another country to be notarized before they can be used or officially recorded or before they can have any legal effect. To these documents, a notary affixes a notarial certificate which attests to the execution of the document, usually by the person who appears before the notary, known as an appearer or constituent. In places where lawyer notaries are the norm, a notary may also draft legal instruments known as notarial acts or deeds which have probative value and executory force, as they do in civil law jurisdictions. Originals or secondary originals are then filed and stored in the notary's archives, or protocol. Notaries are generally required to undergo special training in the performance of their duties. Some must also first serve as an apprentice before being commissioned or licensed to practice their profession. In many countries, even licensed lawyers, for example, barristers or solicitors, must follow a prescribed specialized course of study and be mentored for 2 years before being allowed to practice as a notary. However, notaries public in the U.S., of which the vast majority are laypeople, require only a brief training seminar and are expressly forbidden to engage in any activities that could be construed as the unlicensed practice of law unless they are also qualified attorneys. Yet, despite these apparent differences, notarial practice is universally considered to be distinct and separate from that of attorney. In England and Wales, there is a course of study for notaries which is conducted under the auspices of the University of Cambridge and the Society of Notaries of England and Wales. In the state of Victoria, Australia, applicants for appointment must first complete a graduate diploma of notarial practice which is administered by the Sir Zelman Cowan Centre and Victoria University, Melbourne. In B juridical jurisdictions, such as South Africa or Louisiana, the office of notary public is a legal profession with educational requirements similar to those for attorneys. Many even have institutes of higher learning that offer degrees in notarial law. Therefore, despite their name, notaries public in these jurisdictions are in effect civil law notaries. History. Notaries public hold an office which can trace its origins back to the ancient Roman Republic, before Cicero 106-43 BC, when they were called scribana, tabellius, or notarius. They are easily the oldest continuing branch of the legal profession worldwide. The history of notaries is set out in detail in Chapter 1 of Brooks' Notary. The office of a public notary is a public office. It has a long and distinguished history. The office has its origin in the civil institutions of ancient Rome. Public officials, called scribana, that is to say, scribes, rose in rank from being mere recorders of facts and judicial proceedings, copiers and transcribers to a learned profession prominent in private and public affairs. Some were permanent officials attached to the Senate and courts of law whose duties were to record public proceedings, transcribe state papers, supply magistrates with legal forms, and register the decrees and judgments of magistrates. In the last century of the Republic, probably in the time of Cicero, and apparently by his adopted son Marcus Tullius Tiro, after whom they were named Noti Tironiani, a new form of shorthand was invented and certain arbitrary marks and signs, called Noti, were substituted for words in common use. A writer who adopted the new method was called a notarius. Originally, a notary was one who took down statements in shorthand using these notes, and wrote them out in the form of memoranda or minutes. Later, the title notarius was applied almost exclusively to registrars attached to high government officials, including provincial governors and secretaries to the emperor. Notwithstanding the collapse of the Western Empire in the 5th century AD, the notary remained a figure of some importance in many parts of continental Europe throughout the Dark Ages. When the civil law experienced its renaissance in medieval Italy from the 12th century onwards, the notary was established as a central institution of that law, a position which still obtains in countries whose legal systems are derived from the civil law, including most of Europe and South America. The office of notary reached its apogee in the Italian city of Bologna in the 12th century, its most distinguished scion being Rolandino Passageguerra, generally known as Rolandino of Bologna, who died in 1300 AD, whose masterwork was the Summa Artis Notarii. The separate development of the common law in England, free from most of the influences of Roman law, meant that notaries were not introduced into England until later in the 13th and 14th centuries. At first, notaries in England were appointed by the papal legate. In 1279, the Archbishop of Canterbury was authorized by the Pope to appoint notaries. Not surprisingly, in those early days, many of the notaries were members of the clergy. In the course of time, members of the clergy ceased to take part in secular business, and laymen, especially in towns and trading centers, began to assume the official character and functions of a modern common law notary. The Reformation produced no material change in the position and functions of notaries in England. However, in 1533, the enactment of the Act concerning Peter's Pence and Dispensations terminated the power of the Pope to appoint notaries and vested that power in the King, who then transferred it to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who then assigned it to the Court of Faculties and the Master of the Faculties. Traditionally, notaries recorded matters of judicial importance as well as private transactions or events where an officially authenticated record or a document drawn up with professional skill or knowledge was required. Common law jurisdictions, the duties and functions of notaries public are described in Brooks' Notary on page 19 in these terms. Generally speaking, a notary public may be described as an officer of the law, whose public office and duty it is to draw, attest or certify under his official seal deeds and other documents, including wills or other testamentary documents, conveyances of real and personal property and powers of attorney, to authenticate such documents under his signature and official seal in such a manner as to render them acceptable, as proof of the matters attested by him, to the judicial or other public authorities in the country where they are to be used, whether by means of issuing a notarial certificate as to the due execution of such documents or by drawing them in the form of public instruments, to keep a protocol containing originals of all instruments which he makes in the public form and to issue authentic copies of such instruments, to administer oaths and declarations for use in proceedings, to note or certify transactions relating to negotiable instruments, and to draw up protests or other formal papers relating to occurrences on the voyages of ships and their navigation, as well as the carriage of cargo in ships. Footnotes omitted. A notary, in almost all common law jurisdictions other than most of North America, is a practitioner trained in the drafting and execution of legal documents. Notaries traditionally recorded matters of judicial importance as well as private transactions or events where an officially authenticated record or a document drawn up with professional skill or knowledge was required. The functions of notaries specifically include the preparation of certain types of documents and certification of their due execution, administering of oaths, witnessing affidavits and statutory declarations, certification of copy documents, noting and protesting of bills of exchange, and the preparation of ships' protests. Documents certified by notaries are sealed with the notary's seal or stamp and are recorded by the notary in a register maintained and permanently kept by him or her. These are known as notarial acts. In countries subscribing to the Hague Convention abolishing the requirement of legalization for foreign public documents or Apostille Convention, only one further act of certification is required, known as an apostille, and is issued by a government department. For countries which are not subscribers to that convention, an authentication or legalization must be provided by one of a number of methods, including by the Foreign Affairs Ministry of the country from which the document is being sent or the embassy, consulate general, consulate or high commission of the country to which it is being sent. Information on individual countries, Australia. In all Australian states and territories, notaries public are appointed by the Supreme Court of the relevant state or territory. Very few have been appointed as a notary for more than one state or territory. Queensland, like New Zealand, continues the practice of appointment by the Archbishop of Canterbury acting through the Master of the Faculties. Most Australian notaries are lawyers, but the overall number of lawyers who choose to become a notary is relatively low. For example, in South Australia, of the over 2,500 lawyers in that state, only about 100 are also notaries, and most of those do not actively practice as such. In Melbourne, Victoria, in 2002 there were only 66 notaries for a city with a population of 3.5 million and only 90 for the entire state. Compare this with the United States, where it has been estimated that there are nearly 5 million notaries for a nation with a population of 296 million. As Justice DeBell of the Supreme Court of South Australia said in the case of In the Matter of an Application by Marilyn Reyes Boss to be a Public Notary, 2003, SASC 320, delivered September 12, 2003, in refusing the application by a non-lawyer for appointment as a notary. As a general rule, an applicant for appointment as a notary should be a legal practitioner of several years standing at least. Even a cursory perusal of texts on the duties and functions of a public notary demonstrates that a number of those functions and duties require at the very least a sound working knowledge of Australian law and commercial practice. In other words, the preparation of a notarial act plainly requires a sound knowledge of law and practice in Australia, especially of the due preparation and execution of commercial and contractual instruments. It is essential that notaries in this state have a sufficient level of training, qualification and status to enable them efficiently and effectively to discharge the functions of the office. Historically, there have been some very rare examples of patent attorneys or accountants being appointed, but that now seems to have ceased. However, there are three significant differences between notaries and other lawyers. The duty of a notary is to the transaction as a whole, and not just to one of the parties. In certain circumstances, a notary may act for both parties to a transaction as long as there is no conflict between them, and in such cases it is their duty is to ensure that the transaction that they conclude is fair to both sides. A notary will often need to place and complete a special clause onto or attach a special page to a document in order to make it valid for use overseas. In the case of some documents which are to be used in some foreign countries, it may also be necessary to obtain another certificate known either as an authentication or an apostille from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. A notary identifies themselves on documents by the use of their individual seal. Such seals have historical origins and are regarded by most other countries as of great importance for establishing the authenticity of a document. Their principal duties include attestation of documents and certification of their due execution for use in Australia and internationally, preparation and certification of powers of attorney, wills, deeds, contracts and other legal documents for use in Australia and internationally, administering of oaths for use in Australia and internationally, witnessing affidavits, statutory declarations and other documents for use in Australia and internationally, certification of copy documents for use Australia and internationally, exemplification of official documents for use internationally, noting and protesting of bills of exchange, preparation of ships protests, providing certificates as to Australian law and legal practice, although it was.
Now what everybody's got to understand, is that under notarial law, notional, the word notional and notarial, they're kind of interchangeable, but they're different. So in a notarial law, notional pooling is allowed because it's an accounting procedure. But you have to understand arbitration and debt securitization to really understand how they have a function in the accounting flow. A lot of things that we look at in the accounting world are actually connotative concepts protected by conventions. The conventions allow the connotative concept of accounting to be regulated by third parties. See, in a actual court proceeding, you're really participating in a commercial transaction. It's banking. It is accounting. One party is attempting to hold another party accountable because of some sort of violation of a commercial code. See, laws are codified, so they have been codified to have a commercial implication if you perform under these codes, then there are certain expectations. And if you don't perform under these codes, then there's certain implications that are looked at. And everyone has to kind of really hunker down because of the prison mentality that I just explained. See, in prison, you can see the wounds, but out here, you can't. But even in any prison, they have trustees. So you have to understand that this is not by conjecture or coincidence. There is something happening right in front of us. Keep listening, because if you listen long enough, you just might learn something.
Tax day is finally here. Now what? Trustees, please do not miss out on this opportunity. Tax day is finally here, and taxpayers may be a little bit baffled by that implication. See, normally taxpayers were expected to file their prospective tax returns by April 15th, but due to this recent COVID-19 pandemic, that date moved to July 15th. Now that July 15th is among us, we have to remember exactly what brought us to this new extension date. Taxpayers and businesses will have until July 15th, 2020 to pay their taxes this year, but the filing deadline is still April 15th. The change was announced on Tuesday afternoon by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, following President Donald Trump's declaration of a national state of emergency in the United States as a result of efforts to combat the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic and minimize economic disruption. Last week, the President announced he would ask the Treasury Department and IRS to extend the deadline. Taxpayers and small businesses that traditionally face an April 15th tax deadline will be allowed more time to pay their taxes due but are still recommended to file by April 15th. All individual U.S. taxpayers qualify for this extension and do not have to file any special paperwork or extension requests, as the deadline will be automatically extended. The President also recently released disaster aid, urged each state to set up emergency operation centers and hospitals to ramp up emergency response plans. Also announced is the waiving of interest on federally held student loans during the state of emergency. Taxpayers owing taxes can defer payment of up to $1 million in taxes until July 15th, and corporate filers can defer tax payments of up to $10 million. We're waiting to hear if there will be an extension for quarterly estimated payments normally due on April 15th. We encourage those Americans who can file their taxes to continue to file their taxes on April 15th, Mnuchin said. Because for many Americans, you will get tax refunds. It is expected that most state legislatures are likely to follow suit, since most taxpayers file their federal and state income tax returns at the same time, but be sure to check with your state before making assumptions about payment deferrals. 7 states do not have an income tax: Alaska, Florida, Nevada, South Dakota, Texas, Washington, and Wyoming. Additionally, Tennessee and New Hampshire do not tax wages earned. California had already extended the state deadline to June 15th. VIEPA has a list of changing state tax deadlines. PDF change in the deadline for individuals to pay their annual federal income tax returns is unprecedented at the national level, although the IRS often grants such extensions to more limited geographical areas following disasters. Earlier this month, for example, taxpayers affected by the recent Tennessee tornadoes were granted relief until July 15th of this year. The extended tax payment deadline and penalty relief is likely to be welcomed by taxpayers, said Gail Perry, CPA, a tax professional and the editor-in-chief of CPA Practice Advisor. This is especially true for those who are dealing with family issues relating to the pandemic. The extension is also beneficial to the IRS, as that agency might be facing reduced staffing accompanied by taxpayers unable or unwilling to venture into a government office for assistance. As for tax preparers, we will look forward to a busier than usual summer and fall in 2020. The change will have no effect on the millions of Americans who have already filed their taxes this year. IRS procedures to expedite refunds. A corporation may expedite refunds of estimated taxes by filing either 1. Form 4466, Corporation Application for Quick Refund of Overpayment of Estimated Tax, or 2. a first return followed by a superseding return to expedite the processing of their refunds. Individuals in estates and trusts can also take advantage of the first/second return offering discussed next. Only corporations, however, may use Form 4466 to request a refund of estimated taxes. Form 4466/overpaid estimated tax. In many cases, a loss corporation will have overpaid its estimated taxes when, for example, a significant part of the loss was incurred later in the year. A corporation can file Form 4466 after the end of its tax year, but no later than the due date for filing its tax return, not including extensions. Form 4466 must be filed before the corporation files its tax return. An extension of time to file the corporation's tax return will not extend the time for filing Form 4466. As such, calendar year taxpayers must file their 2019 Form 4466 by April 15, 2020. The filing relief granted under Notice 2020-18 was not extended to Form 4466. A corporation should be cautious in estimating the amount of its liability, because overstating the amount of the overpayment reported on Form 4466 could result in interest and penalties, including a penalty under IRC Section 6655H, when the final tax is later determined on the tax return for the year. Multiple Forms 4466 can be filed during the period previously described. Form 4466 has undergone an IRS processing change in recent years. The IRS conducts identity validation on all Forms 4466 by issuing a 1287C letter, usually about a month after the Form 4466 is filed. A unique code is embedded in the letter, and a responsible officer, who has authority to bind the company, must call the IRS to verify information on the Form 4466. Form 4466 cannot be validated by individuals authorized to represent a taxpayer before the IRS on a Form 2848, POA. Form 8302 can also be filed with Form 4466 to request an electronic deposit of a refund of at least $1 million. First returns. There are three steps in the traditional first return process. An extension is filed for the corporation's return for the tax year. The taxpayer files a first return that generates a refund. Within the period ending with the extended due date of return, the taxpayer files a superseding return that effectively becomes the taxpayer's return for that year. 1. A corporation may desire to file its Form 1120, U.S. Corporation Income Tax Return, or other corporate return, as soon as possible after its year-end to obtain a refund, on an accelerated basis. As a result, questions may arise as to what constitutes a sufficient initial return, first return, how complete a first return must be, and which schedules must be included in the first return filed by the taxpayer. Each return must meet minimum requirements as discussed in this tax alert and must, 1. Be filed on the proper form. 2. Supply enough information to permit the IRS to calculate tax. 3. Be properly signed under penalty of perjury. 4. Represent an honest and reasonable attempt to satisfy the requirements of the tax law. And 5. Be e-filed when required by the regulations unless a waiver to permit filing a paper return is obtained. If a first return is deemed incomplete, the taxpayer's refund will be delayed, the statute of limitations for assessment will not start running, and the taxpayer could face penalties. There has been little explanation or discussion of what the IRS considers to be the minimum acceptable first return. There is some support, however, for not including certain information reporting forms with an original loss return when a superseding return is expected to be filed. The first return should include the taxpayer's best estimate of Subpart F income, U.S. shareholder calculation of GILTI, and IRC Section 250 deduction for FII, in the computation of taxable income or loss reported on such return, based on the best available information at the time. At a minimum, the first return should include at least one Form 5471, information return of U.S. persons with respect to certain foreign corporations, although it is recommended for the first return to include completion of Form 5471 for each of the taxpayer's substantive foreign entities. Estimates included in the first return should represent good faith best estimates, for example, not book numbers imported into the return, and should be reflected as such in the return. The supporting files should document the consideration of the basis of any estimates used. Further, a white paper disclosure should be attached to the return explaining the purpose of the filing to the IRS and the taxpayer's intent to perfect the first return with a superseding return. A superseding return is a return that is filed before the due date or extended due date when a corporation has requested an extension, and changes data reported on the prior filed first return. A superseding return becomes the original return for all purposes. As such, and in contrast to a corporate amended return, a return filed as a superseding return must include all final information, and not just information that changed from the prior filed return. A superseding return that must be e-filed must be a complete XML filing of the entire return, with all required forms, schedules, and attachments, XML or PDF, if applicable. A taxpayer filing a superseding return must indicate the return as such by selecting the superseded return checkbox, designation, in the software, or the return will be rejected as a duplicate filing. Implications. There are various filing dates and return filing order that should be kept in mind to achieve the appropriate results. The Form 4466, Corporation Application for Quick Refund of Overpayment of Estimated Tax must be filed by the due date of the return without extensions. If filing a first return and a superseding return, the form should be filed in the following order. Form 7004, Application for Automatic Extension of Time. Form 1120, U.S. Corporate Income Tax Return, the first return. A superseding Form 1120, before the due date of the return, including extensions. Start speech end. Speech.
All right. Hopefully you guys learned something very, 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 very impactful. Hopefully this information is designed to not only open your mind, but really look at the world of accounting from a different lens, if you will. I'm going to give you one to grow on, just so you can kind of, you know, add this to your notes and pay attention. I spoke to a recent class a while back about different tax forms and how they are applicable. And we talked about the differences between accounting concepts and conventions. So let me remind everyone about the difference between, or what exactly is a disregarded entity, and seven things you should know about a single LLC dealing with taxes. See, business entities can own land, hire employees, and generally and are generally considered separate from their owners. And in some cases, these legally established businesses are disregarded for tax purposes. There can be benefits and disadvantages to owning a disregarded entity. If you are considered a disregarded entity for tax purposes, there are some factors you need to consider. Seven things you need to know about a disregarded entity. Number one, disregarding entities. And so I'm going to break it down. They're going to go through number one. They're going to talk about disregarded entities. Number two, pass-through taxation. Number three, easy tax filing. Number four, limited liability protection. Number five, impact on investors. Number six, additional taxes. And number seven, employment considerations. An entity is sometimes is something that is considered separate or distinct. There are many types of business entities. These include corporations, partnerships, S-corps, limited liability companies, and sole proprietors. Each business structure has different tax implications and other benefits or disadvantages. They are established where they operate and are subject to the state laws and requirements for formation. Let's talk about disregarded entities. A disregarded entity is a business that the Internal Revenue Service and the state ignores for the purpose of taxation, even though they are separate from the business owner. The business income and subsequent taxes are passed through to the owner to be filed with their income taxes. The most basic business structure is a sole proprietorship, in which the owner and business are one and the same. A sole proprietor is not a disregarded entity because the business does not exist as a separate entity from the owner. The owner is subject to the taxes on businesses and business activities, but does not have the legal protection that a disregarded entity might have. In the case of a lawsuit against the owner's business, the owner's personal assets could be in jeopardy. Separating the business from the owner for liability and the reasons lead to the creation of separate business entities such as a corporation and LLC. Can a corporation be considered a disregarded entity? Where there is more than one business owner, the entity is generally not disregarded for tax purposes. Corporations have liability protection, but also pay taxes on business income before it is passed on to the owners or shareholders. Then that income is taxed again at the owner's level. The process is known as double taxation and highlights the key differences between a disregarded entity versus corporations. The limited liability company structure allows for liability protection without double taxation. Instead, just the sole proprietor. The income and taxes are passed down to the owner. When there is more than one member in a LLC, it can either be a partnership or elected to be taxed at the domestic corporation or S-Corp. Those entities can claim eligible business deductions and expenses before passing the remaining income and subsequent taxation to their owners. When a LLC has only one owner, it is known as a single member limited liability company, or what we call an SMLLC, and a SMLL, and then the SMLLC is then considered a disregarded entity. A SMLLC is considered a disregarded entity. Living revocable trust may also be considered disregarded entities. A trust is separate from the owner or grantor, but the grantor can withdraw assets from the trust depending on the grantor's trust rules. The trust provides legal protection and other benefits to the owner, but the profits from the trust are passed through to the owner, who must also pay taxes. Trust can also be used to buy land and real estate. See, a real estate investment trust, a REIT, is a separate legal entity that could be considered a disregarded cases. Assets such as real estate and real properties may also allow a taxpayer to claim additional deductions. That's number one. Number two, what is pass-through taxation, Bazell? The benefits of pass-through taxation starts with the avoiding of double taxation that corporations face. However, this may limit the business deductions that the owner can claim on their personal income tax return. Partnerships, S-Corps, and some LLCs can be passed through the businesses, but not disregarded entities. Taxable income from these separate business entities are passed to the owners to be taxed on their returns, but the IRS does not ignore those business entities for various reasons. A SMLLC has pass-through taxation. The state it operates in, as well as the IRS. Disregard the entity for tax purposes. Also, the Tax Cuts and Job Act passed recently gives tax deductions on pass-through businesses' income. However, due to the complex nature of taxation of both state and federal levels, it is a good idea to consult with a tax professional to find out how your business can benefit. Number three, easy tax filings. The IRS and the state where the disregarded entity is located will disregard the eligible business entity and look to the owner for taxation. This simplifies how the owner must file and pay for taxes. The Internal Revenue Code can be complex, and entities that are not disregarded must file additional paperwork and provide supporting documentation. A LLC tax return depends on how the LLC elects to be identified, either as a partnership, corporation, or disregarded entity. Corporations must file taxes as a business, and then any income passed to the owners or other shareholders is taxed again. S corporations and partnerships pass profits to their members, who are taxed on it, but must also file documentation as a business. A single member LLC disregarded entity would be able to claim the business income on their personal tax returns like a sole proprietor, but they still get the liability protection and other benefits of a separate legal business. Limited liability protection, which is number four. As a sole proprietor, the owner is liable for any legal issues that may arise. In the case of a lawsuit, the owner's personal assets could be seized to cover business debt. To avoid this, you could incorporate or form an LLC. And I just got a little distracted here. form an LLC. Okay, since other business structures are considered separate entities, it limits how courts and lawyers can go over an owner's personal assets. A single member LLC, or what we call an SM LLC, is considered a separate legal entity and is afforded liability protection, even though it can be considered a disregarded entity for tax purposes. It is important to note that the formalities and legalities that must be met to keep the limited liability protection, these requirements depend on the state where the entity is formed. And at the basic level, you must be able to show that the business is truly separate from your personal assets. This includes using the business account to handle the business finances and not dipping into it for personal purchases. There are other ways that the courts can pierce the corporate veil and go after personal assets. Consult a tax professional or lawyer today to ensure your business is properly protected. I didn't write this article. I'm just reading it. Number five, impact on investors. An issue with disregarded entities such as single member LLCs, SM LLCs, is that investors may be hesitant or be restricted from investing in them. In general, corporations or S-Corps may offer the best investment opportunity for investors. Depending on your specific business needs, you may want to incorporate or choose another business structure. Investors will look at your federal tax status, and technology startups may not achieve the best funding from a disregarded entity. If you are considering starting a business, carefully consider your business goals and tax implications associated with each type of structure. Number six, additional taxes. What do you mean additional taxes? Well, besides income tax, business entities may pay a range of other taxes depending upon how they are structured. For example, they can include self-employment taxes, excess taxation, payroll taxes. An LLC disregarded entity such as a SM LLC, as well as non-disregarded sole proprietors, may have to pay high self-employment taxes. LLC taxes for self-employment include both Social Security and Medicaid taxes and go as high as 15% on the top of both state and federal taxes. To avoid this, the owner can also choose to be considered an employee of the business. However, this creates other issues. How you elect to be reimbursed by your company can impact your Social Security benefits later on in life. Payroll tax laws require the company also be responsible for paying taxes on wages given to employees. However, some of the tax amounts are deductible as business expenses. For example, be sure to read the article talking about tax structures for real estate. We'll talk about that if you want to, meaning that those of you that know how to get at me, if you want to know about those tax strategies, just get with me. Employment considerations of business. No, matter of fact, I'm going to stop right there. As you can see, there are benefits to being a disregarded entity. And I read that because those of you that actually have access to our portal can actually read this in its entirety. I just posted this in our Bitrix link. Hopefully what you have heard inspires and motivates you. Hopefully it gives you an inside track to where you should be. Congratulations again. We made it to the end of the fiscal year of 2020. Now it's about 2021. keep listening, because if you listen long enough, you just might learn something.